morning.
Good morning.
And I have certainly been looking forward to this as well. And I understand you have this theme about letting your light shine or getting a brighter light. And I was asked to think of some lessons along that line. So this morning, we're going to begin by looking at light as a figure, a metaphor, as it's used throughout the Bible. So it's kind of an overview. We'll come back and talk about a lot of these metaphors as they're used throughout the Bible in a number of the lessons we'll be looking at throughout the week. Basically, the structure of this study, as I had envisioned it, the lessons we'll be looking at in the evening, Monday through Friday, will have to do with light as it relates to us and letting our light shine and that kind of thing. Today, the two lessons we will have later, the Sunday morning worship hour, and then this afternoon, focus on God as the light. And that becomes something of the foundation, of course, of our own ability to be a light in any sense. And so, preparatory to all of that, we want to just think about light and as Brother Byers has kind of hinted at, I'm interested in teaching this more as a class, as we will have the evening lessons. So if you want to be thinking about that, I don't have any material for you to look at ahead of time and prepare, but you can look at what the announced topics are and be given some thought to that. I'll certainly have some things I will want to say. So it may be something of a hybrid between a presentation on my part and then some discussion or a give and take or Q&A or something like that. And so I'm looking forward to that. And this morning, certainly, as we consider this figure of light, I'll just open it up here to begin with. Again, you don't have much of a chance to prepare for this, so this is kind of cold turkey, but that's okay. We'll just do the best we can. So just think for a moment about the different ways in which light is referred to in the Bible or how it's used as a figure of speech, and we'll use that as a beginning point and see if we can get a kind of comprehensive together. I don't have a board to write on, so we'll have to use the chalkboard of our imagination or something here to remember. All right, so who would like to give us the first to dispel darkness, so we know the power of light to eliminate the darkness, even the most pitch black of darkness, even a match of small light of any kind will overwhelm that darkness. And that becomes a powerful image that's going to be used in some specific ways in the Bible as well. So the idea of light dispelling darkness, in what particular senses is that used in the Bible in some cases? Then you have the darkness of sin, and so God is represented as being a light that can dispel the darkness of sin. What are some other darknesses that man faces that can be dispelled? Ignorance. So we think of light as knowledge. Of course, even having nothing to do with the Bible, we talk about people being enlightened or illuminating, you know, a topic. The light bulb comes on. So the idea of knowledge as light, and that knowledge can just be common knowledge. It can also be revelation, where God reveals knowledge that we would not otherwise know. And so it becomes a very common, you know, figure for God's revelation. We'll talk about that more in the afternoon lesson. There are passages maybe that comes to mind. You know, it's one of those passages. Probably a lot of people know about the Word of God.
One of the thoughts that come up to my mind is the Book of Psalms, that God's Word is it's a light to our path.
Okay.
Giving us direction.
Okay. Yeah, God's Word is a lamp, a light, to light our way. So, you know, that becomes very comforting thought when you consider the alternative. What would it be like to live in ignorance? You know, how lost we would feel if you just had no idea. Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? And sadly, that's the darkness a lot of people, of course, still live in. So we had
the darkness of ignorance, the darkness of sin. Is there another darkness that people face in life?
trials and tribulations and difficulties of life. This is probably its most common usage in the Old Testament, where the psalmist will talk about being in the darkness, and it's some kind of difficulty, maybe an enemy that's afflicting him or something like that, and God will deliver him out of that darkness. Now, of course, you can easily imagine that when you get to the New Testament, that the perspective of the New Testament is that our real enemy is not, you know, our neighbor seeking our harm or some invading army that's coming in. Our real enemy is Satan, and again, we face the darkness of sin that God will deliver us from. That I think certainly is the ultimate deliverance New Testament is focused on. What's another thing God will deliver us from?
The evil one.
Okay, deliver us from the evil one. And when we consider the power of Satan and his influence, again, we can perhaps bundle that together with the problem of sin and all that it represents as being the big issue or difficulty spiritually that we face in life. He's our true enemy, certainly.
It may be related to what we said, that maybe the darkness of emptiness or despair, loneliness.
Emptiness and despair. Some of the consequences or the symptoms of that, you know, the ultimate darkness is being without God. And then, you know, all blessings that come from God, the absence of those blessings would be, again, spoken of in the same sense of being that kind of darkness. Okay? Any other kind of...
Hell.
Okay, hell becomes really a big... you know, how often hell is spoken of as being a place of darkness. We'll think about that. The ultimate absence of God, absence of every blessing of God, absence of his presence and everything to do with him. So it's rightly spoken of as that. And, of course, our
deliverance from Satan and sin and hell and all of those things, you can see how that would certainly go together. Anything else God's going to deliver us from? Captivity. Very good. This is one a lot of people don't think about because light as a figure for deliverance from captivity. It isn't just that captivity is a kind of figurative darkness. In the ancient world, people were imprisoned in caves. So that you were in pitch black. I mean, they weren't going to waste electricity giving you light in your prison cell. Yes, I know they didn't have electricity, but, you know, fire, you know. Matter of fact, we'll go ahead and look at this passage. We're going to come back and look at some representative passages for all of these. Look in Isaiah chapter 42. Isaiah chapter 42, this is one of the great servant songs of Isaiah. You know, verse 1, "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights, I've put my spirit upon him." And we realize how this is quoted in the New Testament and ultimately applied and fulfilled in Jesus. But you come on down to verse 6, "I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you. And I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations," or a light to the Gentiles. And this, of course, becomes another critical passage in the New Testament for the idea that God has always intended that his salvation and his ultimate deliverance apply to all people. It was not, you know, racially specific for Jews to the exclusion of others. It was for all people. Then notice verse 7, "to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, those who dwell in darkness from the prison. I am the Lord, that is my name, I will not give my glory to another." And so very explicitly here, the idea that those that are imprisoned in darkness, and that was the normal procedure for them, they're brought out of the prison into the light. So that becomes a powerful one. Now, see, we probably wouldn't normally think about that, because to us, prisons are about the most lit up places there are, you know. And the lights are on constantly, you know, the searchlights and all that. But for them, prisons were, you know, a very dark place. So there's that idea of captivity and imprisonment. And certainly the New Testament would understand this captivity to be, again, the captivity of sin. That's really what we're enslaved to and need to be delivered into the light from. So that's a very, very excellent one. What's going to happen on the judgment day? Okay, some people will be cast in the darkness. Some will be delivered from the darkness. What are some other things that are going to happen on the last day?
All things will be revealed.
Okay, all things will be revealed. All things in secret will be brought to light. That's another kind of element of light. There are two kind of practical qualities about light that get used in the Bible as well. You know, how often something's done in the secret or done in the darkness and it's brought out into the light. You know, Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 47, you know, what you've heard in the darkness, speak in the light. You know, now it's on the rooftops. So, you know, that's a natural association. What's done in the light, what's done in the open. We would say broad daylight, you know, that kind of thing. But also things that happen at the speed of light. Now, that means something a little bit different to us because we feel like we have calculated the speed of light, you know, scientifically. And that'd probably be something the ancients couldn't really wrap their mind around. But they had some idea of how fast light could travel. I mean, they didn't know perhaps it took 8 minutes for light to get from the sun to the planet Earth. But what's at least one thing they were aware of that traveled very fast that's associated with light? Lightning, yeah. So you often get this idea of lightning that flashes from the east to the west, or the judgments of God are as quick as lightning, or the flashing of light. So those are even some natural kind of, they don't get us into the kind of spiritualized applications that we think of more as the Word of God being a lamp or light, or God, you know, himself being light. And that kind of thing. But back to the judgment day and this last day where everything's going to happen. So that which is secret is brought out. Now, someone else had a hand up.
In 2 Thessalonians, talks about Jesus and his mighty angels coming in flaming fire.
Okay.
Light.
Yeah. So there's that flaming fire. Fire itself they thought of as light, a source of light. Matter of fact, we can include judgment in the category of light, light as judgment. Notice in Isaiah chapter 10, Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 17, and passages like this could very well be behind the imagery in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 17, the light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and briars in a single day. So this idea, again, of the light being like a fire that is destructive, that will burn and consume everything in its path. We don't normally associate light with destruction, but when light comes to us in the form of a fire, it is destructive, or we would know scientifically these days, light in the form of, say, you know, beyond the visible spectrum, you know, X-ray radiation or something, that can be deadly as well. But even if we restrict ourselves to light, can you think of ways that light can be destructive? Okay, you have a blinding light. What's probably the best example of that? The sun, right? And you can understand why in the ancient world, almost every culture thought of the sun as some kind of deity. Because, you know, you go out and you see a tree, well, it's a tree. And you might, in your theology, believe there's some deity lurking inside of that tree or that rock and whatever. But nothing is quite like the sun. I mean, the sun is just overpowering. It's overwhelming. You can't look at the sun for very long at all, and even a glimpse of it, you know, can do damage. And so it can actually blind you, you know. And we talk about blinding light in terms of, you know, you're going down the road and someone's got their bright lights on, you know, like, why are you doing that? You know, we've had the experience. I remember being in Boy Scouts, you know, going on camp bouts, and people have the flashlight and they show it, shine it in your eye. You know, it's like, you know, think about what you're doing. Oh, I want to see your face. Well, yes, but I can't see anything. Well, the Bible speaks of this as well. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is, of course, one of the great chapters where God announces the blessings and the curses that will befall his people for either obeying or disobeying his covenant. But notice Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 28. The Lord will smite you with madness and with blindness and with bewilderment of heart, and you will grope at noon as the blind man gropes in darkness, and you will not prosper in your ways. You shall only be oppressed and robbed continually with none to save you. And so this idea that God would smite people with blindness, that they'd be like a person groping in the darkness. Even if it were the brightest part of the day, they wouldn't be able to see because now they've been made blind. And, you know, you see the prophets picking up on this. Isaiah chapter 6, God commissions Isaiah to go preach and tells him, in effect, the result of his preaching will be to deafen the ears of the people because they don't want to hear the truth, and to blind the eyes of those who see because they don't want to see the truth. And, of course, that's the nature of this judgment. God's not just randomly dispensing judgment at people. But there's a sense in which there's this kind of natural consequence. You don't want to use your ears for what God gave you ears for, which is to hear the truth. You don't want to use your eyes for what God gave you eyes for, to see the truth. Then, you know, you don't want to use them. It'll take them back. And that's also back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. God coming with his angels dealing out retribution to those who do not know God or obey the gospel. And in essence, although the world caricatures that as some mean, petty, vindictive God who, because you violated some little rule, he's just going to, you know, consign you to hell for all eternity. You know, that's not what is happening. It's simply all people are divided into one of two groups, those who want to be with God and those who don't. And on the day of judgment, everybody will get exactly what they've asked for. Those who want to be with God, come be with me. You don't want to be with me? Well, you will go to where God is not. Now, granted, people have no clue what they're asking for when they demand that, but your will be done. That's what the Lord will, in essence, say to them. You go and be Napoleon of your own little empire and see how that works for you. But you have no clue the despair and emptiness. Because you think about it here, even the most reprobate person still enjoys the blessings of God, the blessing of air and food and sleep and companionship. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in a place where there is nothing that has to do with God? All of the blessings we enjoy, even if we fail to acknowledge where they come from, they do come from God, and you'll be in a place where there's none of that, you know. So, you know, it might sound cruel to us, God smiting people with blindness. Well, it's really a self-inflicted blindness is what is happening. They refuse to see. They refuse to hear. But the light, again, can be spoken of, again, in that sense of being an instrument of judgment, that it can actually make those that it see blind, whereas the Bible also uses the imagery that God is more than willing to cause those who are blind to see. So it's just a matter of their own choice and their own heart. you know, what God can do, you know, for them. Well, back to the day of judgment again. Something else going to happen on the day of judgment we haven't mentioned yet. Yes?
Resurrection.
The resurrection of the dead bodies we have. And so this is also one of the darknesses that we face, the darkness of death. Now, it too is kind of bundled up with the problem of sin, because we know that death entered in the world because of sin. And so, you know, this is one intriguing thing. You know, there's a very common viewpoint a lot of brethren have bought into, which is there will be no physical resurrection of the body. We just shouldn't expect that at all. And so whatever resurrection the Bible talks about is just some kind of spiritualized or figurative resurrection or something like that. Well, a couple of problems with that. First of all, if you turn to Isaiah 55, this is freebie. This doesn't really have anything to do with light, other than this is the light of God's revelation revealing these things to us. In Isaiah chapter 55, this is the famous chapter. Everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money, without cost. You know, it's this kind of mixed figure. You know, spend your money for something that's free. You know, why do you spend money for what is not bread, your wages for what does not satisfy? So what's really going to give us what we need? And the answer is it can only be found in God. But notice verse 3, incline your ear and come to me, listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David. In the Greek translation became the holy and sure blessings of David. And you may recognize that phrase as it's quoted in Acts chapter 13 when Paul was preaching in the synagogue at Antioch in Pisidia. The problem is, Paul uses this passage to argue that Jesus was physically, bodily resurrected from the dead. Now, you know, if you're like me, when you first come to Isaiah 55 and verse 3, you're like, well, this verse doesn't say anything about resurrection, doesn't say anything about dead bodies, nothing. How in the world does Paul get resurrection out of Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 3? These holy and sure blessings of David. Any ideas? Well, Paul was an apostle. He just makes stuff up. Well, that's not my preferred answer. Well, I think that is part of it. The promise to David talked about the seed of David who would reign on his throne forever. So there was an association of this eternal aspect to it.
He also talks about not seeing corruption.
Yes, and that's another passage that Paul uses from Psalm 16. You will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. And, you know, so there are some other passages, primarily from the Psalms, that the early preachers like Peter and Paul argued the resurrection of Jesus. And so there are other passages there. There's material that's kind of in the background. But if you look in Isaiah 55 verse 3 specifically, as far as what this text says, there is one word here that ties in with that if you think about it. Sure. The sure blessings of David. Okay, that your soul may live. The earlier part of the verse. So the idea of life as being one of the blessings is part of that. That, again, is more of a conceptual idea. I mean, this is one of the things I tell people. If you want to evaluate a religion, you ask the question, what problem is it supposedly solving? You know, what is the great need that it is addressing? And so just to be silly, let's say that what we really needed are larger television screens, right? If that's man's real need, then the solution would be design and build larger television screens, right? But that's not what our real need is. You know, like it's a man drowning at sea, and you go out there on one of these Coast Guard, you know, cutters, and he's just floundering, and he's about to go under, and you toss him a big TV screen. Here you go. And he would be like, this is not very helpful. Because right at this moment, my problem is, I am drowning, right? Since that's my need, what's the only thing that counts as a blessing? Well, TV screen under some other context might be a great blessing, you know. My birthday coming up, you know, if you're so disposed, want to buy me a... No. We don't have a TV to watch anything. So anyway, in the context, what the man needs is being saved from his drowning. And man's problem, according to the Bible, is sin. And so if God's going to give a blessing to anybody, and it counts as a blessing, it can only be that blessing that addresses his need. And if his need is salvation from death, physical, spiritual, then what he does need is life. He needs forgiveness from his sin, and so on. So the idea of a blessing kind of is part of that. You remember when God spoke to Abraham and said, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Paul quotes that in Galatians chapter 3, and he argues that this forecasts the fact that God was going to bring forgiveness of sins to all people. Well, you say, well, wait a minute. Genesis didn't say anything about forgiveness of sins. It just said God was going to bless people. And again, almost anything could be a blessing. Improved plumbing, you know, pave your streets, you know, good taxation. You know, the only thing that counts as a blessing is the forgiveness of our sin, because that's the one thing we need more than anything. But again, it's the word sure in this verse, of the part that Paul quotes in Acts chapter 13. You think about it, how sure can any blessing be if death can thwart it? It's not very certain. It's only as good until you die. It's kind of like a warranty, you know. You get a warranty on a car. It's good for 3 years or, you know, 36,000 miles or whatever. Well, as soon as you hit that 3 years or 36,000 miles, yeah, warranty's over. It's only as good, it's only valid for that certain length of time. Well, how valid, how good, how certain are these blessings of David if, again, they are thwarted or end at death? But here's the key. In Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 3, and remember, Paul used this passage to argue that Jesus had to be bodily resurrected from the dead, never to have death have any power over him again. And he got that, he concluded that from Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 3. So if Isaiah 55 and verse 3, talking about the sure blessings of David, ensures the bodily resurrection of Jesus, then when you understand the you here is plural, it's not, I will give you, Jesus, the holy and sure blessings of David. I will give y'all the holy and sure blessings of David. It is a promise that is made not to Jesus alone, but to all who are in Christ. And so I don't see how in the world you can argue, yes, Jesus had to be bodily raised from the dead, but God's people should not expect to be bodily raised from the dead. If it's right for Paul to argue the bodily resurrection of Jesus from this passage, then all the other people included in that plural you are also going to be bodily resurrected, and that's who we are as God's people. So there's just explicitly a textual proof of the bodily resurrection of all people, not just a spiritual figurative resurrection. But also, if you just think about it, let's suppose the Bible never said a word about resurrection. Didn't have a peep about it. But if you understood the Bible was teaching that what God was doing was remedying the effects of sin from Genesis chapter 3, you would have to conclude, just by default, that the reversal of physical death was part of it. So the question really is God really reversing the consequences of sin, the spiritual side of it as well as the physical, or is God really doing something else? And the Bible's teaching quite clearly that Jesus is reconciling all things to himself. Jesus is fixing everything, things on earth, things in heaven, things physical, things spiritual. And so, by implication, that would include the resurrection as well. And so, the idea of a physical resurrection not being part of that is, again, a very common kind of thing some people are kind of dabbling in. But I think the teaching of the Bible is very clear about that. So we've got the darkness of physical death, the darkness of sin and all of its consequences, the darkness of ignorance and just being left in the dark. And those are the three biggie darknesses that we face as human beings. And God will deliver us from all of these. And so you see light being used as the idea of knowledge and revelation. It counters the ignorance that we have. We see light being used to describe moral purity and goodness, whether God's moral goodness or our own. You know, let our light shine that others may see our good deeds that are done on behalf of God and obedience to God. And this idea of being delivered, sometimes specifically delivered from blindness or delivered from imprisonment or delivered from death or delivered from sin. So there's just a whole complex of these things we're going to find over and over again throughout the Bible. And then finally, one last very common use of light as a figure is to describe God himself in his presence. So let's look at a couple of passages in this regard. Psalm 44 would be a good place to begin. This is a psalm that speaks of deliverance, so we could connect the light with that particularly. Notice verse 3, by their own sword they did not possess the land, their own arm did not save them or deliver them, but your right hand and your arm and the light of your presence, for you favored them. And so the idea that the very presence of God is like this light. Psalm 104 verse 2 says God puts on light like a cloak, that he is clothed in light. Or as 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 16, that God dwells in unapproachable light. The brilliance of the brightness of the light that emanates from God, you know, and I suppose that would be even some kind of physical manifestation of it in all these appearances we see of God throughout the Old Testament. Light or fire or lightning is associated with some physical representation of God. Of course, that's not really seeing God, but it's some kind of sign of his presence. And you can only imagine that reflects some spiritual reality of whatever the glory and majesty and splendor of God, however that radiant glory is perceived in the spiritual realm. That's who God is. That's what he will be. You know, Ezekiel chapter 1 is this vision that Ezekiel has of God. And the first thing he sees is this great storm cloud rolling in out of the north. And it's just a huge storm. And it's flashing with lightning. And it's just glowing with like the glowing of bright metal, you know, glowing in a furnace. And the one word that occurs most often in chapter 1 is the radiance of God, just this brilliance of the light of this physical manifestation of God in this vision that God was giving to Ezekiel. And we read all the details of that. It's kind of like reading the book of Revelation and thinking, well, there's a lot of weird stuff going on here. But if you strip it down, what God is saying is, this is who I am in all of my glory. This is how I would appear to you if you could have some physical sense of that. And, of course, at the end in verse 28, Ezekiel says, I saw something that looked like something that was like the glory of God. He was not deluded to think he had actually seen the glory of God or even something that looked like the glory of God, but something that was like something that looked like the glory of God. And that's just, again, a reminder to us that all of this imagery, all this metaphor and so on is just, again, an effort to use very limited language to describe these infinite truths about God and His glory and His majesty and so on. And we'll explore some more of these things about God in our two lessons later today and explore these things about how the light applies to us and is lived out in our lives in the five lessons throughout the weekdays that we'll be looking at. Now, in the time we have left, I quickly want to look at two miracles of Jesus that will illustrate some of this. John chapter 9 is a great example of what we find fulfilled in Christ and pointed toward us in Christ. And you may be aware of this great miracle that happens in John chapter 9, that Jesus heals a blind man so that he can see. But not only that, what was noteworthy about this man's particular blindness? Okay, he was blind from birth. And so the idea that some people who've been blinded might get their eyesight back, even in the ancient world, they would probably have been aware of various situations like that. Someone had an infection and it cleared up or something like that. But that somebody was born blind and had ever gotten their sight back, that just was not heard of. And of course, Jesus heals this man and then kind of disappears, you know, off the scene. And that leaves the blind man kind of to stand in for Jesus and become the one that argues Jesus' case. And, you know, you kind of see the man progressing in his understanding that he's this man, but no, he's a prophet. And finally, that he is worthy of worship at the end. But notice then when Jesus reappears at the end of the story, chapter 9, verse 35, the blind man has been thrown out of the synagogue. And, of course, that was the very thing his parents were afraid of. You know, they called the parents in. Is this really your kid? And was he really born blind? And, you know, yes. Now, how he got his eyesight back, we've got no idea. As if you could imagine that their son wouldn't have told them or they would have asked, well, son, what happened? How'd you get your eyesight? You know, they surely knew, and John tells us the reason they wouldn't say anything is they were afraid of being thrown out of the synagogue. They didn't have the courage that their son did. And so, verse 35, Jesus heard they had put him out, and finding him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he answered, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. So here are two truths. You've already seen him, and he's the person standing in front of you talking to you right now. And he said, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. Now, this is intriguing to me because if you remember how Jesus healed the man, he put this kind of clay on his eyes and told him to go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So he was blind when Jesus was with him. He has never seen Jesus until Jesus shows up here at the end. But Jesus doesn't say, you're looking at him. He says, you have seen him. You've already seen him. And what it suggests, of course, is that Jesus isn't really talking about physical sight. He's demonstrated throughout the way he's been reasoning and arguing about Jesus that he has a spiritual understanding of who Jesus is as a prophet, as the Messiah, as one sent from God. And that sight is certainly more important than any physical sight that we have. And that's just a reminder that all the miracles of Jesus are teaching tools that use these, you know, physical visual aids, I guess you might say, to illustrate some spiritual point. And John makes it pretty easy on us. You know, John is the gospel for dummies, kind of. You know, Jesus works a miracle where he changes the bread to feed over 5,000 people. And then John records his sermon, I'm the bread of life. I mean, you just have to be blind not to see the connection between physical bread that is provided and the spiritual bread that he claims that will satisfy our true hunger, which is our spiritual need for God. And so likewise here, chapter 9, physical blindness is cured. But that's not really the point. It's man's spiritual blindness or his spiritual sight. And likewise in chapter 11, Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. Well, yeah, I know one day Lazarus is going to be resurrected. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a spiritual resurrection, that even if people die physically, they will live forever, because that's the real life that God has for us. And you see that point made here at the very end. Verse 39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind. And that sounds exactly like, again, Deuteronomy chapter 28, God's going to smite those that see with blindness. That's the judgment side of it. But there's also the salvation side of it. Those who are blind can see. Those who see will be made blind. And those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, we're not blind too, are we? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains. In other words, I would argue that the Bible doesn't teach that any of us really see. We're all blind spiritually. But those who acknowledge their blindness will search out the answer to their blindness and the sight that God can provide. Those who refuse to acknowledge they're blind and go around and say, oh, I see. Yeah, I see. You know, those that are well don't need a doctor. They don't go looking for a doctor. There are a lot of us here not experiencing any symptoms, don't feel compelled to go see a doctor right now. Now, in fact, we may be physically well, but the problem is there is nobody who is spiritually well. We're all spiritually sick. We all need the doctor. But the difference is those who know they need the doctor and those who refuse to acknowledge that they need the doctor. And so that same language is being used here in the terms of sight and blindness. You say you see, you really don't. And so you remain in your sin and you will never get true sight. If you recognize you're blind, you would do something about it and the sin would be removed and you would receive the sight that God would have for you. Now, I said with one other miracle, we're not going to have time to talk about this, but Mark chapter 8 is the other miracle of Jesus healing a blind man that fascinates me. It's a miracle unique to Mark. It's not found in any of the other Gospels. Verses 22 through 26. Now, this is also an unusual miracle because it's the only miracle Jesus ever attempted and seemed to have failed or fallen short. You know, heals the guy. Partly, he can see men like trees walking around, but he doesn't see clearly. And then Jesus has to, you know, give him another, you know, whammy or something, and now he can see clearly. Well, why did it happen this way? And there's only one possible answer. Jesus wanted to do it that way, right? It wasn't that the man's blindness was particularly challenging to Jesus, or Jesus was tired that day, didn't get a good night's sleep. You know, it had nothing to do with his power or the man's condition. Jesus chose to do it this way, and exactly for the same reason that he healed the blind man in John 9, it's an object lesson of a spiritual truth. And the spiritual truth that's being illustrated in Mark is that the disciples have come to understand Jesus as the Christ. And Peter makes that clear by his confession. But the disciples still have no idea what that means. And that's also made clear by Peter when he rebukes Jesus and contradicts Jesus when Jesus starts talking about the necessity of his going to Jerusalem and dying. And so, yeah, you as disciples are not in the dark anymore like the world is. You've come to have partial sight. But until you come to realize who I am as the Messiah, that I must die, I'm a crucified Christ, you do not see clearly. And so the first half of the gospel has gotten us with the disciples to see partly who Jesus is, but the latter half of the gospel is necessary to see clearly who Jesus is, and that is in his cross, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. Well, I hope the study has been helpful to you to kind of get a little bit of an overview and a taste of a lot of these figures, and again, we'll have an occasion to come back to a number of these and explore them in more detail in some of our later lessons.